So things like electric cars are catching on. But what will it really take to decarbonize our future?
The philosophy used to be, how can we make it more expensive to be dirty? And now the question is, how can we make it cheaper to be green? My name's Jim Stock, and I'm a professor in the economics department at Harvard University.
Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. Most economists would agree that a carbon tax is a powerful tool in fighting climate change, but carbon pricing alone just won't cut it. As green technologies evolve and prices fall, the climate change fight will need a more nuanced plan of attack where people can actually afford to do the right thing.
Even more important is that people understand how big the challenges are that we're facing and how we actually have to make some tough collective decisions that really take us from the ambitious goals that we've set for ourselves to turning that into reality.
Rhoda Metcalf sat down with Jim Stock to talk about how he sees the decarbonization process playing out, which is the subject of his recent article in the September edition of Finance and Development magazine.
There's quite widespread public support to fight climate change. And for a lot of people, that means, you know, should I put solar panels on my house or should I buy an electric car? But reading your article made me think that there's a real disconnect between what the average person believes needs to be done and the actual enormous changes that are necessary in our systems and infrastructure if we're going to put the brakes on climate destruction. Was that part of the message you wanted to put across?
Absolutely. I think that there's been quite a bit of increase in awareness in terms of what the gravity of the challenge that's facing us. Probably the most striking aspects are those are the storms and fires and floods and droughts and so forth that we've been seeing over the last year or two. But just how widespread the challenge is and how many changes it's going to require throughout all of society, throughout all of our lives, I'm not sure that that's fully recognized. And that's something that we really actually need to get to business doing.
Right. You write about carbon pricing and how many economists agree that a carbon price, a carbon tax, should be a naturally efficient way to shift people's behavior away from using fossil fuels towards green energy. And yet, carbon pricing is not happening in a big way in the world. Why not? What's the problem?
Yeah, well, you know, to answer that, maybe I'm going to go back a little bit in terms of the history of economic thought and the history of environmental economics. So early on, for a long, long time, there's been a recognition that if your behavior is affecting other people and in a negative way, the actions that you take, the costs that are borne by others are not reflected in the prices that you pay, that creates an externality or a market failure. And the solution to that market failure is to change the price so that you're seeing the price that reflects the damages that you impose on other people.
Right.
In the context of climate change, greenhouse gas emissions are something that typically are not priced, and they cause damages to current and future generations. And so the logical solution, the economic solution to that, is to impose a tax. And that makes a ton of sense. And when the profession started thinking about these issues in the context of climate change, it was really the only available option because there were not a lot of green, cheap technologies. I mean, solar wasn't cheap. Solar was really expensive back in the 90s. And wind was just very expensive and not developed back in the 90s. And there just were not many good alternatives to using fossil fuels. So really, the solution was to use fossil fuels more efficiently, to use less of them by changing your behavior. But there wasn't any really good solution. So for economists, a carbon tax really was seen as the premier solution. But what's really changed is that a lot of those alternatives now have become much cheaper, so that a carbon tax is an important tool, but a lot of other problems that are market failures actually now are looming even larger.
Well, just to expand a little bit more on what you're saying about how the costs have changed and how that's affecting the way we approach climate change, can you explain this a bit more to me? How does the fact that we have abundant, cheap green energy now change the logic of the battle against climate change?
the philosophy used to be, how can we make it more expensive to be dirty? And now the question is, how can we make it cheaper to be green? And I know that that sounds similar, but it's really a completely different mindset. So if you take wind and solar, the question is, what policies do we need to take advantage of the low prices of wind and solar and to transition the power sector into one that is really a green, inexpensive source of electricity? And that's just different than asking, how can we disincentivize the use of fossil fuels? It also gets at focusing on what other externalities are. And I think it's useful to think that there's actually at least three major externalities. One is the greenhouse gas externality, which we've been talking about. A second is innovation externality. So if you invent something, you can't recoup all of the costs yourself, or you can't get all of the benefits of that invention. So you're going to underinvest in innovations and in inventions. That's a general problem. And the third, which really arises in a few specific cases in the energy space, is the network externalities, or chicken and egg externalities. The best example of that is charging stations and electric vehicles. And if there's no charging stations, then you don't want to buy an electric vehicle. And if there's no electric vehicles, then the private sector doesn't want to invest in charging stations. So we get stuck in the wrong equilibrium.
Right.
Well, let me just pause actually on light-duty vehicles, because it's useful to go through each of those.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of light-duty vehicles...
What are light-duty... When you say light-duty vehicles, what is that?
I'm sorry. Thanks, light-duty vehicles. That's just like normal cars and trucks.
Okay.
And for those, electrification is technically absolutely a feasible option. The prices are dropping substantially of those vehicles. I think that we'll see price parity as soon as, you know, this year or next year in some markets.
So it will be as cheap to buy an electric as a regular motorized.
That's absolutely right. So in that setting, a carbon price, well, what would a carbon price do? A carbon price would make gasoline more expensive, and maybe it would make the electricity slightly more expensive because there'd be shifting to new wind and solar that would be induced, but it would mainly make the gasoline more expensive. Well, if you think about the decision to buy a vehicle, gasoline price is something, but it's really not that much of a factor in your decision, and research has underscored that. And it kind of makes sense. If you have a $40 carbon tax, that's about 36 cents a gallon on gasoline, and your decision to buy an electric vehicle is not going to be swayed by 36 cents a gallon, which is kind of how much gasoline prices fluctuate over the course of several months anyway.
Right.
So that's not going to be a big factor, but it's going to be a huge factor if you can actually charge this thing. So if you live in an apartment building and you can't install your own overnight charger because you don't have the property rights to do that, then buying an electric vehicle simply isn't an option unless there's those charging stations that are available. So it's an enormous impediment. What if you want to go on a 400, 500-mile trip? You're going to have to recharge along the way. And there's got to be a whole set of charging stations on the road that you can count on that are going to be available and they're going to be fast enough for you. Those things don't exist, and those are really holding back the electric vehicle sales in the United States at the moment.
Right, and those are not externalities that can be dealt with a carbon tax.
No, the carbon tax just doesn't have anything to do with that.
Right.
The carbon tax is going to make the gasoline vehicle slightly more expensive because you're paying about 36 or 40 cents more a gallon, but that's just not going to tip the scales nearly as much. And in fact, the electric vehicle could be a lot cheaper, and if you can't charge it, you're not even going to buy one. It's not an option.
Right. I understand that some oil and gas companies are not necessarily opposed to a moderate carbon price, which on the surface seems contradictory. Can you explain that to me?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of features with that. It's not going to have much of an effect on petroleum consumption, because if you've got a gasoline car, you got to drive it, and that price elasticity is really quite small. And at the same time, if you're an oil and gas company in the power sector, what's going to happen is there's going to be a complete, with even a small carbon tax, there'd be a complete shift away from coal, at least in the United States. And a lot of that would go into natural gas. Some would go into wind and solar for sure, but a bunch would go into natural gas. So in fact, oil and gas companies gain by selling more gas to the power sector if there's a carbon tax.
Okay. So if carbon pricing is not the silver bullet, What is the approach that needs to be taken to overcome these gaps and move us in the right direction?
The answer is a little bit unsatisfying, but I think it's the right answer, which is it depends. That is, it depends on the circumstances, it depends on the sector, and it depends on the details of each situation. In light-duty vehicles, in that case, the first priority is charging stations. In the case of the power sector, we actually have mature technologies that are quite inexpensive right now, which is wind and solar, and providing some price incentive to use wind and solar would really make a big difference. All the modeling points to we're at this very close point where if you make wind and solar less expensive or carbon emissions more expensive, that you just see a huge shift in investment towards wind and solar, and we would have a much greener power sector. So in that sector, the order of priority is arguably, first of all, get some price on emissions that's going to tip the scales the way we need it towards wind and solar. Second, deal with long-term externalities associated with R&D for grid storage. And then third, there actually is a network externality issue there, which is transmission. So as you get to deeper levels of decarbonization of the power sector, a lot of the areas where there's renewables is not so much where there's people, and you got to get the power from the renewables to the people, and that's going to require dealing with some institutional challenges, dealing with property rights and how you can actually site transmission facilities.
So what you're talking about there is what? Governments have to create the infrastructure for that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I don't think the government actually needs to create the infrastructure for transmission. I think it's more like the governments need to allow that infrastructure to be created. There's plenty of capital in private markets. The problem is that if you try to site a transmission line in the United States, good luck. It's just really difficult. Transmission lines across state boundaries, or sometimes even county boundaries, you need to negotiate with each of the entities that you're crossing, and that makes it nearly impossible to build interstate transmission lines in the current circumstance. That's a really important practical problem. It's a really messy political problem, but it's something that has to be dealt with.
Has to be overcome. You emphasize that governments and agencies need to be involved in changing systems and infrastructure, but you say that it's really imperative that they design these strategies very well, and if they don't, they could have the opposite effect. You give the example of airplane fuel. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, I think the aviation sector is really interesting. We do not know what the technology is of the future that's going to allow us to have deep decarbonization in aviation in 2050. There's a bunch of things that are on the table or maybe on the lab bench, but we don't know what's going to be the best solution at scale. So right now, that is entirely an innovation game. So what we need in the aviation sector is policies that are going to really support and stimulate bringing up to commercial scale a lot of deep decarbonization advanced technologies, and then we'll just find out which one of them is the cheapest. And my guess is that what we're going to use in 2050, we don't even know what it is at this point. So the best we can do is plot a technological support path and then let the market and inventors and all the companies go at it and come up with the innovative solutions that we need. I think completely the wrong approach in the aviation sector right now is actually saying that we're going to put on an implicit price on carbon by adopting, say, a clean aviation standard. The best example of how that, I think, wouldn't work is a fuel standard that we have in place in the United States right now, which is the Renewable Fuel Standard. The main goal of the Renewable Fuel Standard was to promote second-generation deep decarbonization liquid fuels. It was a complete failure. We don't have a single large-scale cellulosic liquid production facility in the United States as was originally envisioned in this. And instead, what this standard has done is it's locked in place first-generation fuels. So I think we've seen that putting on a carbon price, or at least putting on a sectoral standard that uses a market-based mechanism, is actually not something that's useful for promoting new deep decarbonization fuels of the future.
Why is it that they've been stuck on this first generation. Why has this policy not led to the second generation or more advanced versions of this kind of fuel?
Well, that's a great question. So some people, and I think incorrectly, say, well, the technology never really worked. I just don't agree with that. We never gave the technology a chance. And the reason we never gave the technology a chance is because it was stuck with a standard. So I don't want to get too in the weeds with the renewable fuel standard. But every single standard that exists has a number of loopholes or escape clauses in it that have automatic reevaluations. Can you actually achieve this goal? Let's reassess. And they also have highly volatile prices. Well, if you're trying to think, should I spend $200 million, $400 million, half $1 billion on a cellulosic liquids plant that's going to pay off over the next 15 years, and then you say to your financial person, what's the subsidy I'm going to get from it? And the financial person says, well, at the moment, it seems to be random. We don't know quite what it will be. The price is going all over the place. A few years ago, it was like 20 cents a gallon. Sometimes it's $2 a gallon. But by the way, Congress might kill the program. Well, what are you going to do? You know, forget it. You know, and that's what we've seen. We've seen that the policy let down the people who are making the major investments or willing to make the major investments. A bunch of companies lost a ton of money, and that is not their fault. That's the fault of the policy. So we need to do much better to promote the sustainable aviation fuels of the future and learn from those lessons.
You mentioned that there could be a role for the IMF, specifically the economists of the IMF, in terms of developing better green industrial policies. Could you elaborate?
Absolutely. So if you take this view that things are going to differ from one sector to the other, that we don't have a one-size-fits-all policy, then it's really important to have good economists get down to work on the details of what those policies actually look like. And it's going to vary from one country to another because their renewable resources and their transportation system and so forth are all a little bit different. So what you need is you need to have economists involved in the details of these things, in the details of like a charging station policy. How are you going to make sure that a charging station subsidies with our limited resources are going to actually install the charging stations in the places that you want. They'll be continued to be maintained. It won't just be inframarginal transfers to places that would have installed a charging station anyway. You know, and those are the sorts of questions that economists are really good at. So economists like those at the IMF can really dig in to provide guidance to countries about how they can develop efficient sectoral carbon policies.
Well, Jim Stock, you've given us a lot to think about, and I thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and thanks for having me.
Jim Stock has been looking for answers to the climate puzzle for many years. His research papers are all available at scholar.harvard.edu. And you can read Jim Stock's article titled Driving Deep Decarbonization in the September edition of Finance and Development magazine. Check it out at imf.org/FND or download the Finance and Development app. And look for other IMF podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter at imf_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards.
And I'm Rhoda Metcalf. Thanks for listening.